Sunday with Miriam on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Travel Department. Explore the wonder of the world's most iconic sites with Travel Department, the world discovered together.
There, and you're very welcome to Sunday with Miriam. Coming up in the next hour, comedian Joanne McNally sold out the Hammersmith Apollo and now she's coming home for a string of dates. We'll be chatting about performing, Pino and podcasts. Also today, Belfast portrait artist Colin Davidson and broadcaster Mark Carruthers discuss Colin's paintings of personalities from Queen Elizabeth II to Seamus Heaney and Ed Sheeran, and also survivors of the Troubles in his Silent Testimony series. And chef and businesswoman Eva Pau will be telling me all about her own story and those of other Chinese-Irish she interviewed for a radio series. As always, we'd love to hear your thoughts about anything featured on the show. You can text 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie. You can WhatsApp on 0870 32 32 32. You can tweet at Miriam O'Call, and you can find me on Instagram at InstMiriam. And remember, you can always listen back to the show on the RT Radio app. But first this morning, well, stand-up comedian and podcast host Joanne McNally has just become the biggest ticket-selling female comedian working on the UK circuit, including 7 nights at the Hammersmith Apollo. She's got a massive tour planned here too, and loads of dates are already sold out. Joanne, it's great to meet you.
I know, it's so lovely to meet you. I can't believe I haven't met you up to this point.
I know, me neither, but it's my pleasure. Incredibly tall and beautiful.
Oh, thanks so much. So are you.
But you actually are.
I was going to do this for the whole thing. Bing, bing, bing. I know, I do get, I must give small energy. I think because Vogue is quite tall. But the thing that gets said to me most often by women who listen to the pod who haven't met me is, you're very tall. You're taller than I expected. Yeah. I'm 5'10". I'm a girthy 5'10".
Twin. Now listen, what does it mean to you to sell out so many shows, to be this successful in London? That must be incredible.
It is great. I have a terrible habit. I'm not particularly sentimental. I'm like, what's next? And also, if I'm being honest, I wanted to do well at it. So I was just going to keep going until I wasn't going to stop, really. So I'm not like, I don't guffaw over things. I just book the next show and keep going.
And what is your secret to success? I know that's almost an impossible question to answer. You live over in London now. You've got your own place there. You work incredibly hard, but other people go to London. They're also very talented. They don't crack it.
I think there's a couple of things. Timing is everything. Luck is everything. Like, I kind of got a bit of traction during lockdown, which, I mean, people were kind of forced to listen to people because there was nothing else to do. And then my Prosecco tour before lockdown, I think I'd like won Vicar Street on sale. And then by the time lockdown opened, because women, not just women, there was men there as well, but like we were like rabid animals. We would have gone and watched a duck blow drying its wings, like anything. Do you know, people were just dying to get out of the house. So that's how I think timing was a lot to do with it. And look, and also, and like, I don't have a family, and that's not a poor me, but I don't have a partner, I don't have kids, which means I'm just free to just work. I just work.
You also have a lot of talent.
Thank you.
No, but that's true. Listen, I love how much you talk about your mum every chance. The great Pat McNally. Shout out to her. What does she make of it all?
Well, I think she thoroughly enjoys it now. I think at the start she was very nervous. I think the first time, because I started in a play called Singlehood, and we did a run down in Cork, and and my mum's from Cork originally. She's from Douglas, and all her family still live down there. And one of the cousins saw a poster for Singlehood on a bin somewhere, probably her bus shelter. I don't know where it was. And she rang my mum and she's like, is Joanne acting now or something? And mum was like, she is, but don't tell the family, because she was mortified. Because that was something you'd like, that was a hobby, like it wasn't a job. And then I think when it started working, do you know when it was? I think the first time she was like, okay, I'm behind you now, was when the first time I did the Late Late.
Oh yeah, you made
her,
it.
That is like, oh, that's undeniable now. That's kudos. Someone else thinks you're good in RTE. So okay, I'll get behind this now. And I think now she thoroughly enjoys it.
Where did you grow up? Tell me a little about your background.
So I grew up in Killiney. Mm-hmm. Went to the Loretta Dawkey, very Southside, D4, all that jazz, which I think was a big problem at the start because the accent was... Can I say a handicap? I don't know if that's the correct term to use.
Whatever.
It was something. Yeah. People didn't like it. I've one brother, very normal upbringing, went to university, did English and Sociology, did arts, took me 7 years, didn't have a clue what I was going to do. Really wanted to write, actually. Loved. I was a very good speller as a kid, which I think is a good indication of someone who could probably take pen to paper at some point. But I didn't really have the confidence to do it. And because my family aren't particularly, like, they're just kind of, they're not arty as such. So anything in that genre, my mother was quite nervous of. And I think she was very keen to keep me on the straight and narrow, not something that she could understand. And then I was desperate to do nursing. I actually worked as a carer in an Alzheimer's home for a couple of years when I was in university. But my mum was a nurse. She's retired now. And she was like, no. She was like, you're not doing that. And I was like, why? Because I just thought the camaraderie and all. And I loved, because I went to an all-female school, I kind of naively thought nursing was just a carry-on of that, except now you're maybe allowed to wear more eyeliner, do you know what I mean? Because you're a grown woman. But she was very against that idea because she feels nurses aren't respected enough.
Interesting.
But anyway, then I went in and like kind of, I did the usual fannying around. And then I ended up working as a publicist in youth brands for a couple of years.
How was that?
I really liked it at the start. I had a kind of, I was, as I've spoken publicly about before, I was kind of, what you call it, circling the plug hole of an eating disorder for a very long time. And then once I got into like mainstream employment and realised this was my life and this was an adult, and I felt very unfulfilled by the whole thing. And then I just sort of went straight down the plug hole because it was almost something to do. I think I wanted to be successful at something, and then I didn't have the confidence to go into the writing. The acting had, I never did anything about the acting. I was quite suggestible. Anything to anyone, if I had an idea for something and someone would tell me, oh, I don't think you'll like that, I'd be like, okay, grand, well, what else will I do? I was just very suggestible. So then I just decided being thin would be, that would be my job. Mm-hmm. So that, and then I had to leave everything and I had to leave Peor and I had to go home to my mum's. And that's when I ended up getting into acting and comedy. It was all a very, very lucky weird pivot.
I think a lot of people, though, because I've done a lot of stories on it, about young women in particular who do have eating disorders. And I think it's great that you are open about it.
Yeah.
Because you deal with and you dealt with, and your mum was great, but it is quite common. But why do you think it happened to you? And are you grand now?
I'm grand now because the terrifying thing is when you look back at your life and there's nothing you'd change. So I think to myself, without that, I wouldn't have had to, like I've said before, you know, some people will, I kind of have this very probably sinister take on it that I assume most people have an eating disorder, and then I kind of move back from that. I really do. I think most people have had, and like I know you've spoken about it, and everyone has had this kind of disordered period of eating in their lives. Maybe it didn't take over their lives, but mine did. It took over to the point where I kind of had to press eject on my life, which in hindsight was actually a blessing because that meant I had to recalibrate completely. And if I hadn't had to recalibrate completely, I never would have ended up doing acting, and I never would have got into stand-up, and I wouldn't be sitting here. And I love my life so much, and I love my job so much. I feel so, so lucky. And it kind of freaks me out when I think of all the little sliding door moments that bring you. It was never a plan. I never went to drama school. I never did gigs without someone else suggesting I do them. But the eating disorder thing, it's such a complicated illness. I think a lot of it's cultural. I think a lot of it's obviously your upbringing. I think a lot of it's how you see yourself. And it is a kind of a mental illness, of course. And it's a disordered compulsive side of your brain, which was the big... When I got to the point where I was like, okay, grand, I'm out of my mind. I don't know what I'm doing. It's not a detox. I can't fix it myself. Fine. I hold the hands up. I hand myself over to the professionals. What happens now? And they were obviously meds. And also they were like, we kind of have to remap your brain. And the thing that really frustrated me was like, I don't understand why it's such a big deal to me. Like, why can't I just eat like a normal person anymore? Why is everyone else out during the summer drinking wine and eating ice creams down the pier? And I'm just inside worrying about like sucking calories out of the air. And they were saying, because you've kind of you've rewired your brain now quite detrimentally, and you have to kind of pare it all back, which was very frustrating. But I did find therapy massively, like, it worked wonders for me, but I did it for years.
But that's great.
Yeah, but I'd say there's about 3 sessions that stick out in my mind as kind of pivotal moments where it really rewired my thinking, but I did it for years. It's a very difficult thing to overcome. But then once you overcome it, the release that you have on the other side of it is, it's life-changing. Yeah.
And I think for people listening this morning, you either have one or had one, that's a really hopeful message.
Yeah.
And you're right, you didn't have a plan, but it worked out brilliantly for you.
It worked out brilliantly.
And didn't PJ Gallagher have some role in you becoming?
In fairness, he did. He did. He was a mentor to me at the start. So when I started, the Singlehood was directed by a friend of mine called Una McKevitt. And so once I did that, what actually happened was when I was in treatment, so I went into a treatment program for bulimia and anorexia, but I was an outpatient. So I started writing a blog, which I think still exists. It was called Eat the Pastry. And I've obviously forgotten the login details, so it's still floating around in the World Wide Web somewhere. And then Vicky Nataro actually sent it to... Wow. Life Mag, and then that's how I got a job writing a column in Life magazine. And so then suddenly this new world was open to me, and I was being told by these people who are professional writers, you can do this if you want, we'll pay you to do this. And I was like, brilliant. And then from that, Una offered me a part in her play called Singlehood. And then PJ came to see the play, and then he was very instrumental in getting me involved in stand-up, and he was very encouraging. And I think if it wasn't between Una and PJ, I never would have done any of it, to be honest. So I'm eternally grateful, because I was kind of protected at the start. I didn't go down and do open spots off my own bat at the start, because I ended up going on tour with PJ then, and kind of did 5 minutes in between him and Eric Lawler on his tour, which I think was called Concussion. And then by the end of that tour, I had about 20 minutes, and then I got signed in the UK. So it was quite quick at the start, and I got opportunities at the start. A lot of them were because, well, I was new, and there was...
You were good.
I wasn't terrible.
Yeah.
And as well, there was something trickling down. Amy Schumer had just exploded, and suddenly there was a need or a want for female comedians. So there was opportunities given to me because I was a female comedian. There was also opportunities not given to me because I was a female comedian. But then the opportunities I got, I went in, like, hard on them. And yeah, and I just worked my ass off.
Did you find it scary at the beginning or not? Because even like some comedians, even like the Tommy Tiernans or Ardla Hanlons, they say sometimes going out, even in a small venue, can be terrifying. Did you find it frightening?
It depends. 100%. My God, I would have had to been heavily medicated to the point of coma to not have been nervous. Like, it also depends, even now, it depends what's at stake. So if there's some big platform booker or something at a tiny gig, that gig will feel like you're doing Wembley. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then also, I shouldn't even make that comparison, because sometimes the bigger gigs are less stressful because there's the audience is so far away from you that it's almost less pressure. I remember I did The Albert Hall. Now, it wasn't my gig, it was a charity gig. Kevin Bridges was kind of hosting it.
It's kind of big.
Yeah, no, it is. It is, but I mean, it wasn't mine, you know. It was Kevin and friends, I think. But I hadn't gigged for a while, and I was up the walls before that gig. And I was like, why have I done this to myself? But I knew the second you get out and you get the first laugh, you're grand. Everything goes away. And it's just adrenaline. You just have to kind of channel it the right way. That's what I always say. It's just adrenaline. Like, one time I came off and I was using a Whoop at the time, which is basically just kind of rats you out for your sleep and all that jazz. And the only time my heart rate had basically spiked during the day was for the exact hour and 15 minutes I was on stage.
You've a huge following, but particularly, you know, with younger women, because a lot of your stuff, even with Vogue, is about men and romance and sex, and you're very funny, and you go on about being single and how difficult it is to find men. But any man would be so lucky to go out with you.
You tell them that. They don't see it. It's, but do you know what I always say?
I really mean that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Miriam. I think, listen, it gets to a point where you have to say, as I say in the words of our great philosopher Taylor Swift, it's me, hi, I'm the problem, it's me. It can't all be them, you know? There has to be some accountability. I have to take some responsibility in my role. About the kind of men you attract or the kind of men you're attracted to. And also, like, there's something very freeing I was on such an amazing journey with the stand-up for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And I feel like now I'm enjoying the work that I've put in and I have my own place. You know, I was saying to a friend the other day, thank God, because it was never about money. I was never financially motivated. I just wanted to do something I really liked. And I was always a little stage pony and I finally found my place in that world. But had I not made a penny, I still would have kept going. But thank God it did become like financially viable for me. And I was saying, thank God, or I would have had to have gotten married.
With someone you didn't even love.
I would have to have done something terrible, like get married. But it's not to say I'm against marriage. But I do think there's something shifting in the culture and there's more single, child-free women than ever before. And I was saying, I feel like marriage might become kind of the tramp stamp in years to come where we're like, I understood why you did it, but are you not getting removed? I don't know.
Yeah, because you're so happy the way you are. And I even thought twice about asking it to you, but you do talk about it a lot yourself. So that's why I gave myself permission. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a huge part of my like shows and my comedy and all that jazz. But at the same time, I wake up with these existential crises at 3 a.m. and be like, oh my God, what happens when my mother passes away? And if my brother, you know, and you're on your own, I've all those concerns as well. Mm. And then I scroll on Hinge for an hour and then I ring one of my friends and I'm fine.
We were laughing before we went on air here and I was saying, maybe you need to go for steady eddies like civil servants or accountants or engineers.
Do you know what's funny?
Because you're very funny about the dates you go on. They're the wrong guys.
I love dates. I love dates. They're so fun. And the amount of ones I don't talk about and like, because there was a lot of men then, there was a guy on here. Because obviously when I come back to Ireland, I'm obviously visible on our Irish Hinge then.
Yeah.
And a man messaged me not that long ago. And he's like, I'm just letting you know, there's someone using your photos on Hinge. And I was like, thank you so much. It was me. It was my own account. This guy thought it was a security breach. No, I didn't. I was mortified. That's when I was like, oh, maybe I should come off it. But I also think it's not my be all and end all. I was never going to be the kind of person who settled down early. I just don't have the attention span for it.
Why would you?
Because I think
you're doing so great.
I think a lot of women who are doing or are busy, like my mother was, she's kind of taking the mick out of me, but because I'm always saying I'm just so busy. But you could dissolve into your job for the rest of your life and wake up at 60 on your own, which I don't want to do. Mm. But when Taylor Swift got engaged, she sent me a link and she said, "Are you busier than Taylor Swift?" And I was like, "Wow,
that's Pat, your mom."
Yeah. But also, I feel like maybe because I'm 42 now, I feel like maybe I would be. I could see myself meeting some kind of tattooed chef from London and getting married in Vegas. I don't know. I think, no.
No. I think I'm very into steady eddies.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry. Because you've got all the excitement within yourself.
I don't know if steady eddies are into me, though.
Oh, they'd be so lucky. I think so.
No, some men are, they take, I remember Vogue was trying to set me up with one of Spencer's posh mates. And I was like, firstly, this is never going to happen. Like, I might sound posh, but I'm not appealing to posh lads at all. And she actually said, she's like, I'm not going to show him your Instagram because it is very hostile. And I was like, you're dead right. I'll block him. What's his name? Yeah. I can see myself as, if I was to ever, I'd say, I talk about maybe micro-dosing men, so like two-year relationships. I'll go down the share route now.
And that lovely thing, do you love coming home and doing all the shows? I know you've had that huge success in Hammersmith, but is it fun coming back here?
Well, that's why I left, because I wanted the show to be so tight by the time it got to Ireland, because it's like playing a home match.
Yeah.
So I started in the UK. It's like, they can have the flaws. I'll work out all the issues over there. And then when I come back here, I'll like hit the ground running, as they say. So I've been doing this show since, I started previewing it last January. I haven't done my first Irish show since November. So I've been working hard on this show. And then I get to see all my friends and family when I'm back. So I'm here until pretty much March. Yeah.
Which is fabulous.
Yeah.
How many shows are you doing? Penophile?
Penophile is the name.
We need to pronounce it correctly.
We do indeed. Yeah, we do indeed. Yeah, it has made getting press quite difficult.
And I gather it's coming, Joanne, to Ireland from the 12th of November.
Yes.
Right through to next March, as you say. Yeah. It's in the Three Olympia in Dublin.
Yeah.
The INEC in Killarney.
Yeah.
The Waterfront in Belfast. Belfast guys are nice, by the way.
They are.
Yeah. Maybe that's a good idea. Yeah.
They're good crack.
Yeah.
Sometimes the English lads don't get the sense of humour.
Yeah, Belfast is good. The Royal and Castle Bar and the Cork Opera House. And all the info is on joannemcnally.com. And tickets are from Ticketmaster. Joanne, it was so lovely to meet you.
So lovely to meet you. And congratulations on your book.
Oh, thanks a million. Yeah. Buy it for your mum. Buy it for Pat.
Do you know what? I'm delighted because I read in your article that it took you 20 years to write it. We have the same publisher. So I'm delighted because I've been writing mine for 4.
Oh, great.
So, I have another... It's 17 to go.
Yeah, Penguin Randomise. That's very nice. Yeah, keep going.
I can't do maths.
Joanne, thanks so much for being
my
guest this morning. It's been my privilege.
My pleasure.
And just to say, if any listeners have been affected by our conversation, Joanne, there's great information on eating disorders on bodywise.ie and helpline information on rt.ie/helplines. We'll take a break.